Hello, and welcome to the Global Film Podcast, a weekly discussion of all things cinema. I'm your host, Diego Andaluz, and today I'm happy to be joined by Andrew Zalazar, Managing Editor of Discussing Film.
Hello, hello.
Josie Marie, Founder of Film Posers.
Hello, how's everyone doing?
And Win Lei, Writer for Jump Cut Online, The Young Folks, and In Session Film.
Xin chào, everyone.
So happy to have you guys all on here, and on today's episode, we'll be discussing Chaos Walking, Coming to America, and Raya and the Last Dragon. So let's delve right into Chaos Walking, and this is a film where two unlikely companions embark on a perilous adventure on an unexplored planet as they try to escape a dangerous and disorienting reality where all inner thoughts are seen and heard by everyone. So this one has gone through a lot of production troubles. I think it was supposed to come back all the way out in 2017 at some point, and then through a bunch of delays, it just kept on getting pushed and pushed until now. And it's gotten a bit of a mixed response, mostly negative, but I do want to hear what you guys all think. And let's start off with Josie, who actually really liked the film.
So it's very funny because usually when I tell people that I like the film, they get very surprised and immediately ask me why. It happened like 5 times yesterday. And So I think it's a fun time. For me, I sympathize with the fact that it could have been better, but it could also have been way worse. I think they did very well considering the setbacks and the pushbacks that they got throughout their journey. In terms of a film, I mean, the production design was good. The sound design was good. I really liked the visuals. Again, it could have been a lot worse. It does have its flaws, definitely. But most of the time, I find myself simply wanting more, and that's usually not a bad thing. So those are my initial thoughts on Chaos Walking.
Win?
Well, I'm just disappointed, really. Because to me, after all those second chances, after all the delays, and even like really costly reshoots from Fede Alvarez of Don't Breathe, and that's also a proof that Lionsgate is really not letting the franchise go. Like, they really have trust in this one. Even after all that, they still couldn't find a good film out of it. It's still, Chaos Walking is still a mess unfolding, if you have to ask for my initial thoughts. And if I have to say where the problem lies, it's just, I would point it to director Dud Lyman. He was not the right choice for this film, or even if he did, this film is him on an off day.
And Andrew?
Wow, I actually, this is like the first that I heard of Fed Alvarez working on this movie. So that kind of like threw me off for a bit. I was like, what the hell? Because I'm a big fan of the stuff he does. But yeah, it generally feels like a film of a bygone era. The movie aesthetically in some ways and in some like ways of like entertainment feels like it doesn't belong in 2021, which is like a shame because it has two of like the world's biggest stars like front and center. But yeah, I'm kind of like in the middle between like Josie and Wynn, because I do think it's entertaining, but maybe not for like the right reasons. It's entertaining in the sense that I don't know about, it's just me personally, I found it kind of like really, I couldn't stop watching seeing Tom Holland and Daisy really just like in the most oddest of situations. So that for me, like that made it something worth watching. But at the same time, a lot of it does feel kind of like uninspired. You feel like the pieces of what could have been, and you kind of do feel like it could have been the next big thing considering who's in the movie as well. Yeah, it just kind of feels like a movie that's just going to come and go, unfortunately, even though as much as a fun time as I had watching it, it's like, yeah, I don't see myself or any other people revisiting this anytime soon.
Yeah, so I was a little lukewarm on this one. I mean, it was surprisingly fine for me. I was expecting a total mess, like what the test screening said. And I really thought this was going to be another one of those unwatchable wannabe blockbusters. But in this one, Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley both actually deliver pretty solid performances. And it helps kind of overcome the clumsy storytelling that would have definitely benefited from a longer runtime to flesh out the world. And it results in a competent blockbuster that I think YA fans will definitely enjoy. I'm not sure about anyone else, but it's definitely a fun watch. That, again, if you're a fan of that genre, I highly would recommend watching it. But unfortunately, just on more just film related terms. Again, I do agree that Doug Liman, I think the problem here is because he has had some great films, but he's pretty much a hit and miss director. I think he's one of more of those journeyman directors where it's not really about him. It's more about the actual script. And I think the problem here is with the script and how, I mean, it's a hard concept to adapt, like having to show all these thoughts on screen. And visually, I think it does it quite well. Like the visual effects is great. There's some layering going on there with some past images from other scenes in the film, and that looks pretty realistic and it looks good. But just the way in which they actually choose to kind of show those thoughts, where it's just repetitive phrases over and over again, comes off as a kind of a laughable or a memeable way. And I think that's probably the source of all the issues in the test screening, were all those thoughts, because it honestly just makes the entire film a little bit cheap. If they had maybe taken a couple more years to try to crack how to express that narrative device, maybe in a more cinematic way that didn't come off as clumsy or laughable, it could have been a much better film, and Doug Liman maybe could have actually put something together that's a little bit better, and that it hopefully would kickstart a new franchise. But yeah, I really think that was the source of the issue here.
Oh, if I may raise a question for all of us, because, you know, we're all like in the film community, so we all see the reactions and stuff online. So generally, this is not the worst received movie, right? Like, there are people who are genuinely enjoying this out there. And even the people who don't really like it, they're like, oh yeah, that wasn't like horrible. It wasn't the worst thing in the world. But I've seen other like film critics and et cetera, they've said, for all the issues that this film has had, for the long journey that it's taken for it to come to the screen, I would have found A Hot Mess more entertaining. And the fact that it's just passable is a little bit disappointing. That's not what I think, but I've seen other people say that. So I'm kind of curious as to what you guys think about that.
Well, for me, I think the time frame, you know, between conception and release, and release the second time, and finally selling on it on the third or the fourth time, or something like that, it does get to people. And you really have to consider the fact as well that the knife of Never Letting Go, the source material of Chaos Walking, is all around solid, and it's rather incredible, really, as in, like, you know, you have this, again, this typical young adult novel who we have a main character growing up and then finding out that, you know, oh, the world is not what I imagined, and all these rites of passages that I have go through, they have all been kind of like a big conspiracy or a lie or something like that. So it's, and, you know, it turned out to be something more than that because, well, the concept of noise itself, really, that's the main thing here. It's just, it opens up avenues of layers and discussions. And it is the thing that make this a very, like, hotly anticipated kind of, like, novel, because that is its point of difference. That is what kind of, like, separates it from other young adult novel, and there's a big pursuit kind of premise. So, I mean, what we have on screen is not exactly kind of like unwatchable, but then again, it's a massive disappointment, because all that brilliance on hand and within reach, and, you know, they couldn't crack it, even if after all the, you know, revised drafts of the screenplays and all that, they even brought Patrick Ness, the writer himself, on board. And then, you know, they still couldn't crack it. They couldn't crack what made noise special. And instead, all they did is just adding more noise to the bigger noise in general. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I feel that reception that you were mentioning, because it does have a pretty low overall critic score, even though kind of those first reactions were more mixed, is I think Wynn was saying at the beginning, is that if this film had been made and released right after, I feel that it would have been just gotten a lukewarm reception. But for those who have been in the film community for a while now and who have kind of seen this from like when it was first announced to delay after delay after delay, it does create a little bit of a preconceived expectation that the film is going to be a mess. And again, just like, let's say with confirmation bias, I'm sure like even the best of us are prey to that every once in a while. And I think it's just a case of that showing here that maybe there were a couple of things, especially I think the beginning was quite clunky, I'd say. Like, at least at first, that's when the noise was really jarring to me. Like, eventually I kind of got used to it. Like, it was never something that totally clicked. But those first 5 to 10 minutes were just super jarring in terms of seeing how they dealt with that concept. And I think that just, like, confirmed a lot of people's worries that they were coming into with the film. And then that just ruined it for them from now on. And again, if it turned into something great, then maybe that would have changed their thoughts. But again, since it's just kept on being a little bit kind of like lukewarm slash mediocre, then it I don't think that really changed anyone's opinions, honestly.
I think what I really like is that it did remind me a lot of old young adult novels that I really liked, especially their adaptations like Hunger Games, The Fifth Wave, The Host, and a little bit of Twilight in the score sprinkled in there. But I will say that if it takes for me to rely on nostalgia, I can't see a fault to that. So I really like the action sequences in Chaos Walking, and I think both actors did really well separately. I did not see any chemistry between them, unfortunately, but I did like, for example, that one scene when like Daisy Ridley's riding the motorcycle. I thought that was cool and well handled. Again, I had fun, but I'm not gonna say that it's like my favorite movie ever, but it did what it had to do. It was a fun time at the moment, and I probably won't rewatch it, but I can see the good things in it, especially the visual effects, which usually when it comes to visual effects in young adult novels, sometimes they don't get a good budget and they come off as cheap, as was mentioned earlier. But especially that one moment where he turns his noise into a snake, I thought that was pretty realistic. And I really enjoyed that moment. But again, going back to like the aspect of the noise, I think they were trying to emphasize specifically the fact that he couldn't control his thoughts and he just thinks a lot and it's very overwhelming for him and just that entire aspect. But the thing is that you immediately realize what's going on with him and what's his internal struggle, but they kept like hitting the nail on the head constantly to prove a point, and it's like, we get it. So that could have definitely been handled better.
Yeah, because I think when you have a film like that, it's actually like you could use it as a strength because it's very easy to communicate people's internal struggles or like maybe their motivations, and it should be easier. But I think that, again, you're saying if they had maybe kept it a little bit shorter, that would have worked. But when it just keeps on going on and on and on, it just turns into something clumsy. And the other thing is, even though they had that tool that they could use, I think it felt very rushed and not like in terms of plot, the plot was fine. But I think that it needed a bit more breathing room to kind of explore what the characters, and again, like all the characters, even Mad Mikkelsen's characters and the people in the spackle, to see all their motivations and to see like why they're doing what they're doing. Because I think that it's one of those films where just they're doing something and they're just doing it, but they don't necessarily explain exactly what they're trying to do or explore the implications of it. And it goes through the motions. But it doesn't have much emotion or logical thought tied to it.
If I could add something, speaking on what Josie was saying about Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley, like they're great actors. Like none of us are denying that. And I don't think there's anyone who denies it. People who actually have seen the body of work of these people, they will say that, yeah, like I may have not liked them in this movie, but they're really good actors nonetheless, right? But in Chaos Walking specifically, it kind of feels like what happens when Stan's like fan cast a movie and it actually happens, and then you realize like, oh wait, and it's not their fault, you know, because it's also part of the script and etc. But it's like, wait a minute, maybe just because these two people look really good and they have all these appealing qualities, it doesn't mean that when you put them together it's gonna be like 2 + 2 = 4, you know what I mean? It's not always gonna necessarily equal to success. And it's a shame because these two people, they're great. And I think, well, this could be like a whole other conversation for another day, but I think there's something going on there where you need to like, there needs to be talked about where, how is it that these two people that are like at the top of their game, writing two of the most highest franchises of all time, and yet they don't seem to be getting any hits outside of that, whether it's Murder on the Orient Express for Daisy or more recently with Cherry. I thought it was fine, but the response to Cherry has been nothing but fine, to say the least. So it kind of, it's not adding up there, you know what I mean? So either these people, they need to have a long talk with their agents, or it comes down to the type of projects that are getting handed down to them. And something that Wynn brought up that I thought was really great is he brought up that Patrick Ness was actually involved in writing the script. I think we should point out that he actually has done this before for some of his other books. He worked on the screenplay for A Monster Calls, which is a novel he also wrote. And I think that came out to better results. So I don't think it's necessarily that a lot of the blame could be put on him, because he's done this before. He's worked in Hollywood, especially when it comes to working, adapting his own books. And as we've seen with people like J.K. Rowling, some people, that transition isn't something that is easy. And I think he's kind of proved it, but it's unfortunate there happened to be too many cooks in the kitchen this time.
Yeah, Andrew, I'd say I totally agree with you on that as well. And, you know, with reference to A Monster Calls, again, and this is kind of like my argument, you know, pointing everything that went wrong with or at least like most things that went wrong with Chaos Walking back to Doug Liman. For A Monster Calls, it's again, it is also this kind of like a fantasy, a world out there kind of premise, but then it is used to address a really real and grounded thing that you need to see in order to, you know, to discover. A Monster Calls, it has J.A. Bayona at the helm, and he is, I believe, after his really magnificent horror film El Orfanato, The Orphanage, he understands what grief is and like how a child would imagine a really monstrous guardian in order to shield him from the impending grief of his ailing mother. Doug Liman, all he understands here, all he seems to be proving here to me with Chaos Walking is that, well, dang, I guess I can do a cool action. We didn't need that. We don't need more chaos in Chaos Walking. We actually needed more walking in Chaos Walking. And what's walking here? Walking here is, you know, like properly exploring the planet, properly exploring the concept around noise, and, you know, properly exploring the extraterrestrials in the film. And, you know, just kind of like an asterisk mark here, the planet that that people are seen living here, it's not Earth. It's somewhere far away. It's called the New World or something like that. Not the Terrence Malick film, by the way. But it's, you know, we have so many good, like, tiny little seeds here. All of them are waiting to grow, or all of them are waiting to be fascinated. But Liman looks at them and says, okay, well, here they are, you know? And that kind of presentation, it interests us at first, but then it turns out to be boring, and then it turns out to be something sour in the mouth. So if I actually had noise around the time that I watched the movie, it would be like, oh, this is good, good, this is good, this is nice. No, wait, this is boring, bored, bored, ah, what's going on? This is bored, or, you know, something like that.
No, I totally agree. As per what I said at the beginning, that's exactly it. I wanted more. I wanted to explore the world a little bit more. I wanted to explore the Haven a little bit more. I wanted to explore this back a little bit more, because it also has underlying like themes of colonization and the dangers of colonization, and the film doesn't explore that. And it was such a brilliant opportunity to do that. And just very quick, a little bit into Tom Holland as an actor, as Andrew had mentioned earlier. Can't get really into Daisy Ridley because I haven't been seeing that much of her recently on social media. But I do know that Tom Holland right now is under a lot of scrutiny because he is trying to get more into serious acting again, considering that's how he began. But then, you know, he got into Spider-Man and now everyone sees him as Peter Parker. So at least with Cherry, for me, I did not like Cherry, but I think he handled it well as an actor. And then with Chaos Walking, again, that was for me. I just love watching how he can turn something and still make it work. You know, that was my effect for him. That was my effect from him watching this movie as well.
Yeah, I think anyone who's seen, like, isn't he Billy Elliot? He's in Billy Elliot, I believe. Speaking of, what's the name of that other movie where it's like the tsunami? I'm tripping out right now.
The Impossible.
Yeah. I don't know. I had a brain fart. I don't know why. And we're talking about Bayona as well. But yeah, he's a great actor, and it's just unfortunate. And I think it's a real shame that people only see him as Peter. I mean, it's inevitable because those movies are so huge, and we all love Spider-Man, you know. But I think given the chance, he really doesn't really need to prove himself because he's already given us examples, whether if it's like the Devil All the Time or something like a Cherry. But it's just because he's at that such high of a platform with his name, it's kind of unfortunate because in this movie, it kind of feels like it's almost destined to be memed. Like with Wynn would say when he's like, girl, oh, well, girl, oh, I haven't seen a girl. Oh, look at you. Shut up.
Spicy
girl.
What are you doing?
Yeah, it's just really funny out of context. Which is, if that's good or bad, you want to see the movie, to each his own, you know. But it's kind of sad because he's really trying, you know. And then to see him, I don't know, get naked and then wrestle with the squid, I don't know. That had me. I lost it at that.
That was so weird, and so uncalled for in a way. But I mean, I guess they wanted to appeal to like the Tom Holland fans in that scene. I don't know. Maybe there were ulterior motives because it did not push the plot forward.
I mean, I kind of get the idea, as in, like, it's supposed to be awkward. Like, this dude has been on a planet with all the other dudes, and you know, decorum or you know, like politeness is not. You know, those are not just those aren't in his dictionary. But then, you know, but it's just, again, it's just through the way that they present it, it's very, like, all of it's suggesting to me that it's not a kind of like an awkwardness between two characters, but it's just like an awkward in a direction, you know? It's just, it seems to be always at an arm's length and just, okay, let's just get this over with kind of like mentality. And that's really, for the lack of a better word, that just sucks because, again, like I mentioned earlier, what Doug Liman is having within reach is, it's a young adult novel, but then at the same time, it's not. And he couldn't realize that. It's like you're holding the Holy Grail in your hand right there, but then, you know, all you can think of is just cup.
I mean, I don't know, man. He showed us his ass, so I think he did know what he had in his hands, for lack of a better way to say it.
Again, ulterior motives.
For the stands.
But yeah, I guess my last words on Chaos Walking will be that the way I see some young adult adaptations fall is when people want to treat them as young adult novels. In a sense that, of course, they are young adult novels, but you know that sometimes they don't treat them as really deep material. Well, sometimes they are. Like, for example, a lot of people were criticizing The Hate U Give because at times it felt like someone trying to make a young adult adaptation instead of dealing with the topics and themes that the book is loved and known for. So I think with Chaos Walking, again, it had some deep themes that they just brushed over, and they were like, yes, this is a young adult novel. Let's give some action. Let's give some romance and call it a day.
Yeah, overall, I think this is another case of seeing something that works, and even in Lionsgate themselves with the Hunger Games franchise, and just trying to get something out that's similar to it in a very rushed way and kind of leaving behind everything that made the book special to try to fit into this cookie cutter young adult action adaptation, to the point where it was so apparently so messy that they had to actually delay it. And by the time that it's out now, I don't necessarily think it's very relevant, and it just seems as a kind of a misfire in terms of trying to set up all these sequels and all these future franchise plans without even trying to tell a solid narrative that works from start to finish.
Yeah, I think at this rate, we'll just have to wait for an eventual reboot down the line. And by reboot here, I'm not saying another big budgeted blockbuster, but a miniseries even. Just like the way that the Golden Compass was given life again, like its big second chance after HBO and BBC stepped in to do his Dark Materials. Now that's brilliant. Now that is the way to apparently to allow the story to really go, to really go on and go into what it's supposed to be, rather than this the blockbuster that was envisioned, and then it turned out it's just that popping up all these questions from executives, and all the answers seem to be just make it simpler, and that is the knife that guts the film that you get to see.
Actually, does anyone have anything else to say? Because that's a perfect final statement.
just that I like Wynn's wordplay. This whole time
I mean, honestly, the best part of the discussion so far.
I guess early mornings work for me. Let's do this more often.
For sure. So anyways, now let's move on to Raya and the Last Dragon. So in this film, in a realm known as Kumandra, a reimagined Earth inhabited by an ancient civilization, a warrior named Raya is determined to find the Last Dragon. So this one has come out to much praise and much fanfare from pretty much everyone who's been watching and reviewing it. So I want to start off with Wynn, who actually created an incredible thread about this, highlighting Southeast Asian journalists who have been covering this film. So thank you for that, because it's great to bring light to things like that, of course. So I just want to start off with you and hear kind of your thoughts on this film.
All right. Are you all ready? Do you think Sirius Black had it bad that he waited for like 12 years? I waited for 98 years for Walt Disney to, you know, give me a film that is about my culture, or, you know, in other words, a film that is made for me. And you know what? Actually, I didn't even know I was waiting for something like that. But then now that the very thing that I didn't know that I waited is here, and it's just all around brilliance. Sure, it's familiar, but then just to, you know, kind of like rework the bowl of soup philosophy that is represented in the movie. To me, it seems like the familiarity, the tried and true beats of an adventure film is kind of like, it's just a bowl. It's just a kind of like container. And then what really matters is that the ingredients that go into the bowl, and the ingredients that were put in there, holy cow. It's not only fun, but it's also strangely cinematic, and it's very sharp as well. And I guess it helps when you have two directors on board who made some of my favorite films of this past few years. Don Hall from Big Hero 6 and Carlos Lopez Estrada for Blindspotting.
Josie?
Honestly, whenever you mention the people behind this film, I just get so happy, because you can really tell that not only do they have a good background, but they put that background into the work. And sorry for the redundance, but it did work. For me, Raya can be described easily as a visually dynamic masterpiece. I loved Raya as a character. I loved Namari. I loved the voice acting in this film. I loved the action sequences. I love referring to the battles and fights as choreography, because usually you never talk about animated sequences including choreography, but it just felt so fluid and so natural and so real. So I love the amount of detail that went into the sequences. I will say that I do agree with a lot of people saying that the first act was entirely exposition and it kind of trumps it just a little bit. But for me, I mean, this is still a solid A. This is a solid A film.
And Andrew?
Going to come in with some spicy takes right now. I think it's undeniable how much craftsmanship and like mastery is on display, because it is true. Like, it's undeniable. The film looks amazing. The time and effort that went into crafting this, whether if it's choosing the right talent to voice these, bring these characters to life, etc. I will ride to the ends of this earth for Kelly Mary Trench. That woman can do no wrong. She's absolutely the shining light in this film, in my opinion. She's great. I mean, I loved her. I've loved her ever since the moment that I saw her in The Last Jedi. But going on from that, I think this, as good as this movie is, and it is good, like undeniable, I'm not saying it's anything less, but as good as it is, I do feel while I was watching it that it was slightly hindered in becoming something even better, right? And for me personally, when I'm watching something, as much as I enjoy it, one could be more recently, like, not to go off on a tangent, was like the WandaVision finale. It's like, it's good. This is not bad. Absolutely, it's not bad. But there's stuff happening that's hindering it from me truly being like, from it truly putting my jaw on the floor. And there was something similar that with Raya. It's like, it looked beautiful, but it also felt like it was not necessarily at odds with itself. But the best way that I can describe it is that when the best Disney movies, the ones that we still talk about today, whether it be like A Lion King, Aladdin, I still talk about Lilo and Stitch to this day, but those are for different reasons. But those movies, when we first saw them, whether you were a kid, an adult, however, you weren't necessarily, the thought of it being a Disney movie wasn't necessarily in your mind. And maybe it's a little bit unfair because those movies came out first a long time ago, but that's a thought that I had when I first saw Moana, for instance. I was completely immersed. I was not thinking about anything else besides what was going on screen. For Raya, with all the greatness that it does have, there are a few, like, I'm not going to say inconsistencies, but there are a handful of beats. Now, during myself watching it, it can go from something that's like Mad Max-esque, from like Raya riding her dung beetle animal on the desert. I'm like, well, this looks freaking amazing. What the hell is this? Like, I've never seen Disney do anything like this. And it looks like dystopian. And then it goes into this battle sequences. And then it goes to more familiar, like, comedy that it's not necessarily within the same tone as the film. And then it's in moments like that where I'm like, oh, okay, like, I forgot I'm watching a Disney movie, right? So, and there's stuff, like, there's Disney-isms, you could say, like, the way that it opens with the exposition, and that to me is fine, because those are things that necessarily aren't hindering the film from becoming any less greater. Like, that's just, like, a familiar building block, but it's not one that I'm totally against. But there are moments where I did feel like, I was like, this is good, but I feel like this could have been, like, the next big thing to take everyone by storm. You know, even people who have no idea who Raya is, people at home who are like, should I pay $30 to see this movie? Like, I felt like there's moments where I could have been like, absolutely. And then there's moments where I was like, I don't know. It's a very hard question to answer, because it's undeniable the representation and what this movie will mean for a lot of people. But in a sense, it gets a little bit too familiar where it does make me gives me second thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I felt that Raya and the Last Dragon was a heartfelt blast. I think the animation was just absolutely stunning. There was so much detail in every frame. And one of the things that I do want to highlight is the superbly kinetic action sequences. Now, those, I believe, Carlos Lopez Estrada and Don Hall actually commented and said that they were very inspired by John Wick and films of that caliber in terms of how they directed the action. And apparently, the original cut was actually rated R, and they had to tone it back down a little bit just because of how intense the action was. And I think you could definitely tell that in the final cut. Of course, it's rated, I believe, PG, but just it's very different from other Disney like films where they kind of have some action elements. That this is very much, when it comes to the battles, they're very, very well done, and it comes off almost like an actual, like a live action film, which is incredibly impressive. And honestly, I think this film stands tall as one of the best recent offerings from the studio. I mean, I think an action adventure tale like this, I mean, there's things like Atlantis and there's things like Zootopia, but honestly, I think this is the best Disney live action film probably since maybe The Lion King, at least on a first glance. That's what I thought. Now, it does have those Disney-isms, like, as you say, that do hold it back a little bit. And I think for that, like, if it maybe had totally devoted itself to the tone, to like a single tone or a more coherent tone, it may have been even greater, and it could have truly been like one of the best animated films of all time if it had kind of committed more to that tone. But I think for all of the things that it tried to do, it did kind of fall prey to a couple of Disney-isms, a little bit of comedy that sometimes worked, but sometimes it felt a little bit jarring. However, it does work as a strong, crowd-pleasing blockbuster, and it's very ambitious, and I think it's definitely going to be fun for the whole family.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, thank you for bringing up Atlantis again. And if I have to say that, I just hope that after this film and after realizing that, hey, I dig this joint, then maybe it's also kind of like an opportunity for people to go back and revisit, or maybe even, you know, like reassess Atlantis, The Lost Empire, which is also this kind of like adventure to another world, and at the center of it all, a mystical gem kind of deal, you know? Mm-hmm. And to me, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, you know, was underappreciated, even though, again, a lot of it actually, you know, when you put it side by side to Raya and the Last Dragon, it's kind of similar. And this is why I think all your thoughts about the Disney-isms of the film are valid, because they are still adhering to a formula. And, you know, just to reference what I said at the beginning, like, this is the bowl, this is the container that they're using. But as it turns out, ultimately, what they have here is still very, very much its own entity. It's still very much like a very unique branch on the same tree. And so we can have, we can still have a great time with it, and we can still appreciate it, and we can still, we can still be happy that, you know, it, you know, these things can coexist.
Yeah, agreeing a bit with Andrew, I do see there is a shift between a tonal balance, because you do have serious moments, and then the comedy is brought in kind of abrupt at times with Awkwafina specifically. And sometimes that ninja baby. But in terms of the film itself, looking at the positive side, you can see it like a bowl of soup. There's a little bit for everyone. There's a little bit of Indiana Jones here. There's a little bit of Tomb Raider. There's a little bit of Atlantis and Treasure Planet as well, agreeing with that, because it does remind me a lot of late 90s, early 2000s Disney. And then you do have the comedic parts. Like, for example, to me, the baby with the monkeys was kind of for the fans of Illumination and the Minions, like bringing in that crowd. It has a little bit of everything for different people.
Oh, no.
It feels like a people pleasing film. But again, I enjoyed it mostly because of the heart at the center of the film and these aspects of trust and setting your pride aside for the greater good of humanity.
All right, let's talk about these babies, okay? Because I have a very similar... I agree with you, Josie. Everything you just said, I agree with. But whenever I talk about this with other people, and the best example I can think about recently when talking about Disney specifically is that bit in Incredibles 2 where Jack-Jack fights the raccoon. Now, I talk about this and people like, Andrew, it's a kid's movie. What are you doing? You're getting mad that they're appealing, that they're appealing to kids in a kid's movie. I'm like, no, like, hear me out, because like, I don't think children's animation, kids movies is anything less. You know, I feel like these are the movies that introduced me to cinema, you know what I mean? So I treat them with the same respect and the same kind of like standard I would do as any film, you know, regardless of what, if it's about minions that fart and make stupid noises or whatever it may be, right? So in Incredibles, I really did not like that sequence, not because I was being like a grumpy old man and I'd be like, oh, this is not my Incredibles. It's just that I felt like the movie paused and it was like, okay, we're going to pause the movie and we're going to give you like a Looney Tunes bit for the little kids for the next like 2 minutes. And then we're going to resume the movie. That's what that Jack-Jack scene felt like to me. And it feels very similar to me with the baby and Raya, where it's like, all right, we're going to pause the movie and we're going to give all these little kids something to laugh at for a minute or 3 minutes. And then we're going to resume the movie. And it's kind of like babies like that or like a trope within themselves in films. Like we talked about, like, where there'd be minions or stuff like The Incredibles. But it is kind of like inconsistent because like it does feel like out of place because it does feel like the whole world is so serious and it's so like dystopian and it's all about all of these very mature things that I think are very important for children to like to be exposed to. And then there's like, oh, but wait a minute, here's a baby with monkeys. Wait a minute, you thought you saw everything. Here's a baby, you know, watch it juggle or something like that. And it doesn't feel like if it belongs almost. Like, this is not in the same movie. It doesn't feel like it's from the same movie. And going off of that, Awkwafina, when she first comes out, feels very similar. And it's nothing to bring her down because I think she's fantastic in the role when she's given the opportunity to show some layers that are not necessarily known from Awkwafina, which is like showing, imparting wisdom, being silly, but also one of the smartest people in the group. You know what I mean? I think there's a good balance between that. But when she's first introduced, again, the movie's like super serious. It's like the world is dying. People all everywhere, they're mortified. They're in stone. Like, how are we going to save everyone? And then she comes out and just like, hey, everybody, what's up? And it's I understand the appeal, but when it goes on for too long, you're like, okay. Like it becomes more jarring. You know?
Yeah, especially going back to Jack-Jack, I think there it was a little bit warranted in terms of him being able to use his powers and like actually fight someone, so to speak, quote unquote. But that was already established. We already saw him, especially in the first one, with a sequence similar to that. Here it came out of nowhere and I was like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing. And I did get used to it, but looking back, I can see how that takes away from the film and why it would make me like take down a few points. Because again, it just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think if it had a more kind of balanced tone or it had like a little bit more foreshadowing of like from the start, like, okay, like it's definitely has some serious moments, but it has some comedic moments as well. I think it would have worked better. But the problem here is, again, that it comes out of nowhere and it's tonal inconsistency. I think that's what it is. Because if it had leaned into that aspect from it from the start, okay, I might have thought, okay, it's a little bit childish, but like at least that's what the film is going for. But it does feel like sometimes it's just like kind of going out at all places and just seeing what sticks. And again, most of it does stick. Don't get me wrong. I really like this movie. But there were certainly some parts like that just felt a little bit jarring and offbeat.
Well, I have to say that I see where y'all are coming from, and they're all valid, really. I do feel that the characters Noi and her band of cute little catfish monkeys called the Ongies, they do diminish the overall overall vibe the film is going, but then at the end, which again I will not try to spoil here, but you know, apparently it just works, it just weaves into the theme of you know, unity, not in the sense that all the lands can come together, but then for all the lands to come together, all the ages, all the demographics have to come together as well. And it's the way that they portray that, it's a very, you know, succinct and beautiful, really. But to me, the my main problem with the film is just that, kind of like in its introduction to a new culture, they can't settle on a specific Southeast Asian culture, just like a, you know, just like with the same specificity that Coco had. But then they just have to, you know, lump us all together. They lump Vietnam, they lump Laos, Thailand, Myanmar, Brunei, and Thailand. It all goes into a blender. What comes out? Is it tasty? Yes. But at the same time, I can't lay claim that, hey, this movie is about my culture. I can only say that, hey, parts of my culture are in this, and I can see myself in it. But then at the same time, you know, that last part, I can see myself in it. I think that's the key thing here. I think that's the key lesson to take home here. It's just, you know, I haven't been able to see me on the screen for quite a long time, or whenever I do, it's just again, it's a Vietnam War film, or, you know, bullet-ridden bodies, or what was it? Bad Times at the El Royale, where 123 Vietnamese are like fallen because of this just one Peter Parker-esque Tom hotel manager. And I was like, oh my goodness, is this how Vietnam is seen? So Raya and the Last Dragon provided something else, and you know, all that they are providing to you is just that, hey, the Southeast Asians, they have really cool stories that they are so eager to tell you. They have really cool things that they really want to show you. They have the greatest foods that are being animated on screen, and now you can see them. So, you know, with all its flaws, it's not like I'm not letting them, you know, off the leash. I will point them out right there and then, but then at the same time, it's kind of like catching a unicorn, you know, catching the last unicorn, maybe, if we really want to weave in the film title here. But finally getting it, and then finally realize that, hey, we've been waiting for you. This one is made for you. So Raya and the Last Dragon is like a cute little gift, you know, with a bow on it for me. And at the same time, I can only hope that, you know, this is only the first of more gifts down the line. And the next gifts, they will be really specific to that culture, like a fully Thai film, a fully Indonesian film, a fully Malaysian film, or, of course, a fully Vietnamese film.
If I could raise another question to you guys, because I've been talking about this movie with a lot of people, and that what you just brought up, when about it being a whole bunch of things together, unlike something like Coco, which is very specific, right? If there was something that you could have come, if you were like in the writer's room or whatever, if there's something that you could have potentially changed, because we've all agreed that this movie has a lot going on, and it would have probably been better if it was a little bit more streamlined, per se. One thing that comes to my mind right away, and I kind of understand why, during the movie, I was kind of lost on this. I was like, why is this happening? But then at the end, I was like, okay, I get why they did it. But there's a lot of characters in this movie, a lot of supporting characters, and some get introduced very late in the game, some get introduced very early. And my guess is that each one of those characters is supposed to be, or obviously a representative of each of like the lands in this film. And each of the lands are obviously inspired by a different Southeast Asian country, whether it be Vietnam, Thailand, or even like Singapore, I feel. But it also brings this to mind, where like, okay, well, you know, we're talking about Disneyisms. What is it? What is a traditional Disneyism? The main princess has to have like an animal sidekick of sorts. And that's fine. I have no issue with that. That's not going to hurt the movie. That's fine. They do that. I like that. That's cool. She has Tuk Tuk, the big beetle, like gerbil, right? But then She meets a kid, and it's going to be like a kid sidekick. All right, that's cool. Then she meets another little kid, and she has two kid sidekicks. And then that kid sidekick has animal sidekicks as well. So now there's like five animal sidekicks, and there's two kids. And then we're going to be, you know what I mean? It starts to pile. And it's like, well, you already have an animal that's cute. You know, you don't need more. Or you have a little kid that's smart and witty and who can hold his own. You don't need another one. You know, that's something that I thought about. It's like, wow, this, if I could go back, I would probably redefine the cast. I understand why they did it at the very end, but it's still like a lot of people and it's a lot of dialogue and they're not all necessarily as fleshed out as the others. Even though some of them do come with some nice surprises, I will say, I will admit that some of them, Benedict Wong's character specifically, I thought came with a really great surprise, but it's still a lot of people. And then I spoke to someone and they told me that maybe making less lands, making it a little bit, making the world as big as it is, literally not making it so divided so that the movie has more time to explore each one. That's something that I've heard. So I'm curious as to what you guys think.
Merchandising.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Josie, I guess. Merchandising for sure. I mean, I buy the heck out of the Anggi's plush, or yeah. I would even buy Tuk Tuk if it's out there for real. I mean, I need to really upgrade my janky Corolla right now. So a Tuk Tuk in my garage? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Love it. There is a purpose to it, but you know Disney has ulterior motives when it comes to these films, especially, I mean, when you make the animal sidekick really cute, you that plushie is coming to my house.
You know, just to come back to you know, Andrew's point. Yeah, I do. I do think that, you know, it's there's a whole lot of piling on here, and maybe it's for corporate reasons, or maybe it's for, you know, it's a kind of like a, how do you say it, a shaky move in terms of making narrative decisions from the team. But then at the same time, all of that is proving to me that, you know, the people who are behind these films, like the directors, Don Ho, Carlos Lopez Estrada, and the writers, Adele Lim and Kui Nguyen, they really trust what they have made. They really trust this world. And, you know, they are, what they're banking on is not from the sales of all the dolls or the miniatures or the plushies, but they're really banking on us, you know, to, you know, visit Kumandra again down the line. Maybe not to search for the last dragon anymore, but maybe to search for something else that is, you know, of equal or even greater significance. And, you know, I do hope that maybe we do get to see this world again, because this world is really memorable for me, and it's very distinct. It's not specific, but then comparing to, you know, other Disney films, it's very distinct. It's something different, at least. So maybe a big budget part two, or maybe a series. I wouldn't dig the series route, but hey, it's it's at Disney's discretion. It's not me. But there's a whole lot of promise here, and you know, I can just hope that we get to see Kumandra again. Or if not Kumandra again, if this is all that we get to see of that world, I am happy with that too. But hold out, please, please, please do hold out the promise that I do get to see the same crew behind Raya and the Last Dragon doing something else down the line, just to, you know, benefit the genre in general.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I really hope that the hopeful success and the apparently big budget release of Raya and the Last Dragon really persuades Disney to start moving towards more and more diverse cast and crews, both in front and behind of the camera, and to tell those stories that maybe people 20 years ago wouldn't have been allowed to tell, but now that they have more opportunities in their cultures, they can like properly express them at the in the studio atmosphere that they deserve, as well as also the return to kind of those Disney action adventure flicks of the 90s, the early 2000s, that even though maybe they didn't have as much financial success, they have built a cult following since. So I really hope that this shows to Disney that they can, in fact, produce more ambitious and more action adventure diverse films in the future. So now I think it's a good time to move on to Coming to America. And in this film, the African monarch Akeem learns that he has a long lost son in the United States and must return to America to meet this unexpected heir and build a relationship with his son. So Andrew, I believe here was the only one who saw this one. So let's just start off with you.
Yeah, so I honestly can understand why the reaction to this film has been what it's been, mild to say the least. There are, I mean, Coming to America, the first one from 1988, it is a revered classic. So I understand why there was like a lot of potential for this and why it had a lot of eyes on it. But I thought it was fine. It was solid. I would be totally lying to you if I said that I didn't laugh my ass off a few times, and that I do think that it's one of, or if not the strongest sequel that Eddie Murphy has ever made. Now, the competition isn't all that, because you have like Nutty Professor 2, you have the Beverly Hills Cop sequels, which are not as good as the first one. And you have, if you count Shrek, then absolutely Shrek takes it. But I'm talking about movies where Eddie Murphy's like front and center. And unless I'm forgetting something that is like some kind of hidden gem sequel, I think this one might be the strongest. But even then, it's not perfect, you know. But I think it did what it had to do. I think what it makes up for, and maybe predictable beats, some jokes that maybe don't land to some, is that I really don't think, especially after Dolemite Is My Name, that Eddie Murphy and his team came into this movie with the notion that they're just going to make another rinse and repeat sequel. I really don't think that's the kind of process that went into this, and I think that saves it, because obviously I can't really speak much to this because I myself am not Black, but this movie was the first movie, Coming to America, was one of the first films that pioneered the idea of what Black excellence in cinema can look like in the mainstream, right? There are, of course, other examples, but it's one of the first ones in the mainstream, like a big John Landis comedy. Shout out to him, who's a bad person. We're not going to talk about him anymore, I promise. But a big comedy by a big studio director, you know, that had a big star at the time. It kind of pioneered this idea. And now since then, we've had Black Panther. We've had Beyonce's Black is King. There are other examples as to what Black excellence can not only look like, but the many ways that artists can express this idea and theme, whether it be through a comic book movie or a film that's woven together by music, right? So, and obviously the film knows this, that it can't just be really, really low bar, because there are so much expectations as what to do. And the movie has Wakanda jokes, right? It pokes fun of itself here and there. But the movie, I think, does take itself very seriously at the end of the day. Because if we wouldn't have taken itself seriously, then you wouldn't have had Academy Award winning costume designer Ruth Carter, who's worked on a bunch of Spike Lee films, who won the Academy Award for Black Panther, to come and design all the costumes, bring on this world to life. So I feel when there's aspects like that, that went into actually crafting, bringing back this world with delicacy, especially in the modern day, and what it's going to mean to a lot of people, I think that elevates it as a sequel. It may not be as better as the first one, but to be honest, when it comes to movies like this, when it's like, oh, the first one came out over 30 years ago or whatever, like, you're going to love it. Like, they're never going to be as magical as the first. Like, they're just not. But that doesn't mean that the movie can be really good on its own or can find its own merits. And I think this manages to do some of that.
Yeah, for sure. So I came into this one, and I mean, I hadn't really seen the first one until recently. And this one, I think I'm a little bit definitely mixed on it, because it is extremely messy and there's a lot of it that doesn't work. But let me just start off with the good, I'd say, and that is the impressive production value. As you were mentioning, everything from the hair and makeup to the costume design to the production design is just exquisite. Like, you can definitely tell they did not spare a cent for just getting this to look as good as it can be, even though the cinematography is a little bit Well, it's like the generic comedy cinematography that we see nowadays, but the production value is incredible. And Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall and Wesley Snipes too, but mainly those two, they deliver some brilliant comedic performances where, again, they're going back to their old tropes of just playing a million roles. I believe I counted like maybe Eddie Murphy playing three or four different characters and Arsenio Hall playing like another, I think three, I believe. But those were always the best parts. I mean, those were the parts that really made me laugh. I mean, there were a couple of stuff here and there that were a little bit problematic, but overall, I think those performances just really made me laugh. So I think that was definitely one of the main positives. But in my opinion, I think for a film called Coming to America, it stays way too much in the Zamundan Kingdom. For all its budget and all its scope, it did feel a little bit contained, and I'm not sure how I feel about that coming off of the first one. But I mean, honestly, just it's a very messy and it's overstuffed. Like, they try to throw everything in there. You were talking about Raya throwing everything on there. If you thought that threw a lot on there, this throws on even more. Like, it gets a little bit sometimes even hard to follow, which for a comedy sequel like this is definitely not a positive. And the other thing is that there were definitely some jarring sequences. Like, when it turns into the music-based celebrations, I felt as if it was just turning into a glorified music video, which, again, the production value was incredible, but it just seemed to kind of divert from the narrative just to, like, focus on musical performances for a couple of minutes, and then turns back to the narratives. And there were just a couple of jarring things like that that really took me out of the film.
Okay, you know what? I'll defend those sequences. Because the best way that I can describe it is that, and it's funny that you brought up Arsenio and Eddie playing different people, because he did that in the first one, but obviously Eddie has built a repertoire for himself in the last few decades or so, where, you know, like the movies that he was starring in and that people were getting to know him from were movies where he's like literally 10 different people. And that kind of like, I felt put like a bad rap. And obviously those movies, whatever you want to say, they're not the best. I know people who would say a lot worse, and believe it or not, I know people, in very real people who I've met in real life, who will defend Norbit till the end of this earth. So, you know, so to each his own. But for those sequences, the best thing that it reminded me of, in terms of a sequel at least, is Anchorman 2. And this might be a little, my people might be like, oh, what is he talking about? But I really like Anchorman 2. That movie is stupid. That movie is random, but that movie is funny as hell. And it's the right kind of random. Now, again, the sequences in this movie, they come out of almost nowhere. You're like, what the hell is going on here? Why is this happening? It's random, but it's not necessarily random just for the sake of being random. Like, there is a sense of, it's almost like controlled chaos, if I will say. And that's the right kind of random that reminds me of like stuff like that I see in Anchorman, right? The stuff that is so stupid and random, but I'm having a good time. So can I really complain? So there was some of that in this movie. But going back to Eddie Murphy playing different people and some stuff is problematic. I think I know what you're talking about. Are you talking, when you say it's problematic, Diego, are you talking about that one joke he says in the barbershop?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. That one. Okay, so that one had me at first, but then it took me out. I was like, wait a minute. I was like, what did he just say? But it kind of does feel like, you know, Eddie, he's kind of, I'm not saying he's out of his, well, I'm not saying he still has it. He can still make me laugh, right? But that just kind of proves that the whole shtick, you know, it's not the same anymore. It's not being different people with the heavy prosthetics and like being like three different people in the same room. It's not it doesn't work as well as it did even like 5 years ago. You know what I mean? Like that stuff hasn't necessarily, that whole bit hasn't really aged the best. I thought some of it was funny, especially when one of Eddie's characters starts talking about like MAGA and starts talking about Nazis. I thought that was funny. But without a doubt, as all the messiness that it does have, again, when compared to the other sequels that he's made, it's still stronger than them. And if someone were to make like a ranking of like, here's all the movies where Eddie Murphy plays five different people, right, ranked, then this one would be closer to the top, absolutely still.
Yeah, and now I just want to bring in Wynn and Josie, who I know they said they had a couple of questions, because I don't believe they had a chance to see the film, but they have definitely heard a lot about its buzz and about kind of how it's been. So just feel free to jump in whenever you guys want.
Yeah, specifically with this film, I've just found it very interesting because I remember a lot of people were, to say, hyped for the film. And then recently, it's been dead silent. Crickets on the Twitter. And most of the times when I see it on my timeline, it's promotional material from the official Twitter and like the like VOD platforms and everything just trying to push the film. And I'm just very curious as to, do you think it was initial reactions that caused this, or do you think people have actually been watching it but they haven't been quite enjoying it?
I think it's the latter, because honestly, if this was a, like a terrible film, then I think that would have at least gotten some sort of a Twitter response, like, oh, this is like, even Chaos Walking a bit has gone a little bit like, oh, this is like, this is actually fine, or it's like terrible, terrible. And here the cases that I think most of the early reactions, I do think that they were pretty lukewarm on it. I hadn't seen many people who were like absolutely loving it. Or absolutely, I mean, I have seen a couple people who absolutely hated it, but they weren't as vocal. But it just, I feel that this film just doesn't feel as passionate, or as doesn't feel like as if it has a very like passionate voice behind it. And I think that does translate to a little bit of a forgettable comedy sequel that, again, no one really has many thoughts on it because it's serviceable, it's okay, but there really isn't anything going on there that needs to be derided or celebrated apart from kind of its initial premise. Because I know that Paramount was going to actually release this theatrically, and I know they've been kind of offloading most of their stuff, but this would have honestly been a great debut for their film, for their platform. At before I had watched the film, I thought it's obvious that this could be a great film to kind of like use to launch their platform. But I think they saw in it what a lot of people are seeing now, where it's just, it's not very something that's going to be talked about much. It's already been forgotten by most people. Like, it's a very forgettable film, and I think that's what has contributed to not having much of buzz.
If I could chime in a bit in there, is that I think, one of the things that could go into what we're talking about, well, there was a lot of buzz, and then what happened, is that maybe, I don't know, because, you know, Hollywood likes to think in formulas, right? So they like to think in like, oh, again, we've been talking about all this podcast, right? You get Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley in one movie, and then it's a hit, right? They like to think like that, right? So like, oh, you get a classic movie from 1988 and you bring it back, right? It's going to be a hit, right? Like, they think in terms like that. But maybe, I mean, we would have to wait a little bit more to see what these results are. But just on a first look, maybe this kind of stuff isn't necessarily as successful as what Hollywood thinks it is, right? So maybe making sequels or bringing back characters from long gone won't bring in as many audience as much as they think they will, right? Because we're living in a whole new generation of moviegoers, right? So there's a lot of people watching this movie who are going to be introduced to the first one for the first time, right? And that can either be really good or really bad, because either they don't like this one and they don't want to even see the first one, or they like this one and then they see the first one and then they find out that the first one's like a lot better. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword in a way. But what you said quickly, Diego, about Paramount, for some reason, they've been, before the launch of Paramount Plus, they were launching or selling a lot of their films to other places, and they were shopping them around. And it got really confusing to the point where it's like, well, don't you guys have like a streaming service coming out? Why don't you just wait, right? Well, because it's kind of, they should have just waited, because Paramount Plus came out on the same week anyway, right? So what was the whole point of you selling it to Amazon? Right. Besides maybe getting more traction with advertisements, getting a head start on the promotion, maybe. But then, like, I don't know, it's kind of odd, because it would have been a really good film. It would have been, because the only film that they had to launch Paramount Plus was the SpongeBob movie. And that movie's been located everywhere else around the world since last year. That movie's like on Netflix in like the UK, Canada, etc. And it's been there. So it kind of really doesn't, I kind of don't understand what the logic was with that was.
Holy moly. Really? There is a Norbit Hive out there operating and active?
Yeah. It's so funny, because I grew up watching that movie, and as a little kid, I thought it was funny, but you know what I mean? But like, when I got older, I was like, oh, wait a minute. A lot of this stuff is like, is not good, you know? Or it's not necessarily, I guess you could say, like, some of this might be a little bit problematic, right? But believe it or not, I have met people in real life who, again, this might sound fake to people, who will recite the dialogue of that film in the same voices as Eddie Murphy and will not miss a beat, because they think that movie is very good. And I think it's, you know, it's to each his own, but There are people who will fight for that era of Eddie Murphy. They're not many of them, but those people exist. Like the people who like Meet Dave, Norbit. He did a few. Oh, there's that one, 1,000 Words. Like all those movies he did in like the mid 2000s to the early 2010s. Those are long gone because I think Eddie's definitely could come back from that. And I mean, Dolomite may have been like a very big high point where it's like, oh man, like Eddie Murphy really has not lost it. It's just that maybe he wasn't making the best decisions choosing projects at that time for whatever it may be. But I read in an interview that the next movie that he wants to do is going to be Beverly Hills Cop 4, which again, another legacy sequel to a movie that came out like the start in the 80s. It might see the same fate as Coming to America. But after Beverly Hills Cop, he said he doesn't really want to do acting anymore. He wants to stick more to stand-up comedy. And if he were to choose another film role, it would have to be something that was like a really vision-driven project that he would have to come out of his semi-retirement for. So I don't know. I still like Eddie. I think he's still funny. Coming to America is not on the same high as Dolomite Is My Name, but I think that movie only came out in 2019. So like, it's very obvious that this dude, if he puts himself to it, that he could still produce amazing results. So I don't necessarily want to see him retire, but you know, it's up to him. And hopefully, I mean, I've seen the Beverly Hills Cop movies. I think they're funny. Like I enjoy them, but I wouldn't want to see them make a fourth one when the third one's already kind of bad. Make them the fourth one and just have it be kind of like, you know, rinse and repeat. Which I don't necessarily think Coming to America is, but I would want it, you know, to exceed my expectations, you know? And Coming to America just kind of barely met them.
Yeah, again, I think that going back a little bit to what the whole Paramount sale on Paramount Plus, it was a little bit of a strange decision to sell it exactly when Paramount Plus is coming out. Because now I don't believe they have like a major title they can advertise until kind of a delayed release of A Quiet Place 2, which is still like 45 days after its theatrical release. So it's not even a full-on big streaming-only release. So that decision was a little bit strange. And regarding Eddie Murphy, I do feel that this film was a little bit dated. And I think it's a little bit of a bad thing. Like it may not have truly been able to click. That's another thing that I think may have prevented it from being like truly out there and passionate. But I think that also those comments that Eddie Murphy made, I assume that he's probably already signed up for Beverly Hills Cop 4. But with this one, I think that he's definitely feeling that it's very much just kind of like churning out comedies. And I mean, he's been doing that for a while now. And I think that just he realizes that that's not just, it's just something that he doesn't want to do anymore. And I think, I mean, I've seen some of his stand-up comedy, and I think that if he really goes back to that, that could be a great, and I'd be there for every time. But I do agree a little bit with him that I think it may be best to maybe just wait until, especially if he wants to delve into more dramatic acting and something that's really vision-driven, I would totally be there for that as well. Well, that's it for this week's episode of the Global Film Podcast. Where can we find everyone on social media? Win?
All right. Well, I always need more friends. I could always use more, you know, like-minded cinematic folks. And you can find me on Twitter at NLE318. And on Facebook is Nguyen.Lay.334.
Andrew?
I am always up for engaging in more of these type of conversations on social media, even though I know at times it can feel like it's the most toxic place on earth and it's like maybe not where you want to meet strangers, but trust me, I'm not like that, and that's not the type of conversations I like to have. So you can follow me on Twitter at AndrewJ626, and of course you could always see the stuff that we're doing at Discussing Film at Discussing Film.
And Josie?
And you can find me as at the Josie Marie on Twitter and Letterboxd, and if you'd like to follow Film Posers, you can find us at Film Posers basically everywhere.
Nice. So you can find me personally at the Diego Andaluz, and that's AndaluZ on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd, as well as the podcast at Global Film Pod on Twitter. And thank you everyone for coming on board. Thank you all for listening, and make sure to rate, subscribe, and follow us to be notified when the next episode comes out. Next time we'll be discussing Cherry and kind of talk the good and the bad of the film. We're gonna have people there who loved it, we're gonna have people there who hate it, and it's going to be an interesting discussion for sure.